Once again, Solomon tells us that in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 15 that foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. With that in mind, it's interesting to note how many times Solomon comments upon the consequences of a foolish son. In Proverbs 10:1, for example, it says, "A wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish son is heaviness of his mother." Proverbs 15:20, again, "A wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish son despises his mother." Proverbs 17:25, it says, "A foolish son is grief to his father and bitterness to him that bear that to her that bear him." And then in Proverbs 19:13, "A foolish son is the calamity of his father." In just those four verses, a foolish son represents heaviness, spite, grief, bitterness, and calamity. Those proverbs kind of remind me of another human interest story from another Reader's Digest that I had in my files. There was a mother who on her 41st birthday had received, among other presents, an extravagant, expensive wrinkle-removing cream. And a friend that was there when she received the gift, she says, "Well, what did she give you?" From her teenage daughter, by the way. And she said, "What did she give you the year before?" And without hesitation, the mother said, "The wrinkles." That's sometimes just the way that it is. As a matter of fact, that's probably nearly always the way that it is. Take your Bibles, if you would, and I'd like you to turn to Ephesians chapter 6. We've read the fifth commandment now started out some of the past messages, reading it from Exodus, Deuteronomy. And we've read it from here already several times. This passage has seemed to come up several times already, but I want to read it now as the text for this message from Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 3. Where we find that it says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and thy mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth." Someone once said that if we're ever to love a butterfly, we must first care for a few caterpillars. And that's the way it is sometimes. As a matter of fact, it's probably nearly always the way that it is. I know sometimes Linda has often said, as she looks at specifically our sons, how she's wondered how in the world they, with what they are at those early ages, can turn into be men. It's just like it's an amazement to her. Well, sometimes we've got to raise a few caterpillars to get the butterflies. This will be the fifth commandment, part 5. In the previous four messages, we examined the fifth commandment statutes of fear, listen and obey, of despise not, curse not, rob not, and strike not. In this message and in the next message, I'll be addressing two final statutes. I don't know if you caught it or not in the last message, but in the Mark 7 Corban account, as I'll call it, or incident, that in that incident, Yeshua viewed children as being responsible for their parents in their old age. Now, it's of course always the opposite the way we normally view it. It's always that parents are responsible for their children. But there comes a point in every child's life when he becomes responsible for his parents. Responsible for his parents in their old age. Let's turn there again to that account in Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7, and we won't read the whole account this time, but beginning with verse 9. Mark 7, verse 9, "And he said unto them, Full well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own tradition. For Moses said, Honor thy father and thy mother, and whoso curses father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, If a man shall say to his father or mother, It is Corban, that is to say, a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, he shall be free." Let me see how far I want to go here. Verse 12. "And ye suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother, making the word of God of none effect through your tradition which you have delivered, and many such things do ye." Now, from that incident, how do we know that children, that is older children, are responsible for the care of their older parents? Well, first we know that Yeshua was addressing the Pharisees in this account. That is, grown men. His admonition, of course, primarily dealing with their rejection of the laws of God in order to keep their own traditions. But in the specific incident that he's using here, and of course that we're centering in on regarding the keeping of the fifth commandment or a statute of the fifth commandment, he was preaching to grown men. And to those grown men, in verses 11 and 12, Yeshua chastens them. Again, listen to it. He says, "But ye say, if a man shall say to his father or mother, it is Corban." Again, Corban is a dedicated gift to God. "It is Corban," that is to say, a gift, "by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me," the parents, that is, "he shall be free. And you suffer him no more to do aught for his father or his mother." End of that quote. Thus, in Yeshua's sight, those grown Pharisees were obviously responsible for their parents. And from this account, were obviously also, were likewise responsible inside of the law of Yahweh as well. Since the whole point of what Yeshua said in this particular account was to illustrate obedience to Yah's laws versus the tradition of men. Consequently, we should expect to find a provision for parental old age care, if you will, in the law. So, with me, if you would, turn to Leviticus chapter 19. As I mentioned in one of the previous messages, so often, and especially because of how Paul related preceded the fifth commandment in Ephesians 6, which we just read, by saying, "Little children, obey your parents," most people, when they think of the fifth commandment, I think, are like I have been in the past, who think of it as applying to only young parents, younger parents of younger children while still in the home. But as I pointed out, the only time that the word children is ever used in relation to the fifth commandment in the Old Testament is when speaking to the children of Israel, obviously meaning both adults and children alike. This is a commandment, and as we see, especially with this message, this is a commandment that without question has no boundaries as regarding the age of the child. The child is always required to fulfill this commandment to their parents and its statutes as well, which of course explain the commandment. In this case, Leviticus 19 in verse 32, it says, "Thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man and fear thy God, I am Yahweh." Well, there's one of those terms again in the King James, the hoary head. You know, we hear that today and we think of, you know, obviously somebody who's got an ugly face and that's scary, you know. What is that hoary head there? It comes from the Hebrew word sabah, which is the same word translated gray head in Proverbs 30 and verse 29, where it says, "The glory of young men is their strength, and the beauty," or New American Standard says, "honor of old men is the gray head." It was just a term that was used in reference to an older or elderly gentleman or lady. We are, in other words, we are, according to this verse, admonished to honor the aged. And as we can see from this verse, I mentioned this, I think, in the very first message, that there's an amplification of this commandment that goes beyond just parents. We're going to see that more in the next message in a little bit different area, but it extends to anyone older than ourselves. One of the statutes is that honor is due to whom honor is due, and especially in relation to those who are older than us, those who are our elders, as you will, not elders necessarily in the church, but elders to ourselves. The same application here applies. Turn also, now keeping that in mind, turn also to Leviticus chapter 25, verses 35 through 37. Leviticus 25, verse 35 through 37, it says, "And if thy brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt receive him, yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury of him or increase, but fear thy God, that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase. The first part of verse 38, I am Yahweh your God. That's known as what we find in that particular passage is known, or what we might today call hospice care. Now, someone may be wondering, what do those two passages have to do with parental care? I mean, the parents aren't specifically mentioned there. Well, if honor, and in some cases hospice care, is due to a stranger, to even a stranger, then certainly the same, if not greater honor, is due one's parents, is it not? I mean, that should go without head. We're talking about the hoary head, the older man, the older woman, in the previous Leviticus passage, and there is nothing that directly, we know that that Christ was referring to the law, and these are the only two passages, specifically the previous one, that comes anywhere close to dealing with parental care. It must be the verse, and so it not only applies obviously to the stranger who has the hoary head, but to our parents certainly as well, if not more so. And such a parent, when old and possibly feeble, left to fend for themselves, is certainly not being honored by their children. Let's look also to the New Testament, not specifically related to parents, but certainly applicable to parents. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And just verse 14, it says, Now we exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, and listen to this, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, be patient toward all men. And again, I ask you, if that's generically the way that we as Christians should treat the feeble-minded and the weak, how much more so our parents when in the same state? We have become a society of people who seldom, if ever anymore, show hospitality to strangers. Now, there's maybe some good reasons for that in certain instances, but sometimes we've allowed the exception to overrule what should be the rule of what the Scriptures make it clear. Not that we're not to take some precautions and be careful in what we do, not that we're just not to open our doors to anyone and everyone. I mean, there are passages that even deal with that. We're not to promote or to encourage the Antichrist, for example, or obviously a wicked man who could endanger us. But for the most part, we have become a society. Even the Christian part of our society is still the norm in our society. They aren't leading the way and showing otherwise, for the most part, who seldom, if ever, show hospitality to strangers, and in many cases, even to their own parents. That's how far removed we have become as a people. And I'm talking even within Christian circles as well. Solomon was more specific with his admonition concerning older parents. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 22. Now, one of the reasons I think that is that not only that our Christianity is much different than it was in the first century, but one of the primary reasons is that the Christianity of modern times, for the most part, and again there are exceptions, but for the most part, this antinomian, anti-law mentality of the majority of Christianities have wiped out not only the law, but the biggest majority of the Old Testament. The Old Testament, for the many Christians in many denominations, has become an unimportant document. Very seldom used, very seldom referred to, very seldom read, very seldom studied to see what God would have us to learn from it. And when you cut out the three-fourths of the Bible, you're going to lose God's standard for our lives in many, 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 many ways. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 22 tells us, it says, Hearken unto thy father that begat thee. And then it says, And despise not thy mother when she is old. Despise not thy mother, obviously would apply to your father as well. Despise them not when they are old. This is without question, describing a heart condition. A bad attitude, if you will. And again, normally when we think of of parents being scorned upon or held in contempt, we normally would think of teenagers. But as I pointed out in one of the previous messages, that certainly is not contained within the teenage world. There are many grown adults today who still despise their parents, despise them even more as they grow older, and maybe more dependent on their with their needs. But without question, it is dealing with a heart condition, with a bad attitude. But one of the ways that such contempt is exhibited is in turning out or turning away one's parents in their old age. The Apostle Paul makes it clear that the first line of defense for widows, and I'm confident that the principle also applies to older people in general, no matter what the gender. You know, the widows were just the ones who were the most likely to be abused and lost in the things, especially in that day and age. The men often, because of the age gap that was often between the husband and the wives, the men, as in Joseph's probably case with Mary, that's why I think we don't hear any more of Joseph, is that he was probably maybe 20 to 30 years older than Mary. That was a common practice at that time and would have died, you know, when Yeshua was at a very early age, leaving in many cases women at an early age as widows and destitute at the mercy of whoever if they weren't being taken care of. And so widows are centered in on here by Paul, but obviously I think it would also apply to, again, older people or other destitute people, no matter what the gender. But he points out, the point being is that the first line of defense for the widows or other such people is the church. That's right, the church, not the government, as it's known today. Actually, the church, the ecclesia, as the word comes from in the Greek, the church, the ecclesia then, was to be the government for Christians. The idea of what we have of church today is so narrow of what the word ecclesia in the Greek entailed then. It was to be the government for Christians at that time. That's made especially clear, and we won't look at this, but for as an example, if you're writing this down, that is made especially clear in 1 Corinthians 6, verses 1 through 5, where the Apostle Paul chastens Christians for looking to the pagan courts of law of their day to settle their disputes. Essentially, he was telling them, set up your own courts and handle it. First of all, it's wrong for you to, you know, it's better to be wronged by your brother and forget it anyway. But if you've got a dispute that you've got to handle, don't go to the pagans to have it handled. Set up your own government within the ecclesia and settle those disputes. That's just an example. However, today, since the church has neglected its responsibility to form and to be its own Christian civil body politic, another ecclesia, and that's right, that word can be used in the fashion I'm going to use it, because ecclesia just means an assembly. That's what the word means. It's not a church. It's not a church building. It's not a Christian church. It's just an assembly. That's what that word means. Another ecclesia, another body, another assembly, another government, a pagan civil body politic, has stepped in to, quote-unquote, fill the vacancy, because the church is let down. However, in spite of that, don't miss that I said that the Apostle Paul made it clear that the church was to be the first line of defense for widows and older people in general. The church was to be the first line of defense. From what? Well, not that it wouldn't be more than this, but from children who were not or are not fulfilling their responsibilities to their parents. Turn with me to 1 Timothy chapter 5, and we'll just read what Paul writes about this. 1 Timothy chapter 5, we'll be beginning with verse 3. It'll be verses 3 through 16. We're going to read a little bit lengthy passage here, but it's worth the reading. 1 Timothy 5, verse 3, it says, "Honor widows that are widows indeed, but if any widow have children or nephews," King James probably would have been better. That was King James. New American Standard says, or grandchildren, which is probably the better translation of the Greek word there. "But if any widow have children or grandchildren, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents. For that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth, and these things give in charge that they may be blameless. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man, well reported of for good works." And I put in here Dorcas, you know, from our class this morning in the book of Acts. I thought, I don't know if she was a widow or not, but she would have. Had she been a widow, she would have qualified as being a widow indeed in this case. "Well reported of," verse 10, "well reported of for good works, if she had brought up children, if she had lodged strangers, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every good work. But the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton against the Christ, they will marry, having damnation because they have cast off their first faith. And withal they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some are already turned aside after Satan. If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed." Now, there are a few things that should be noted here. Verse 4, for example, from the New American Standard Version for clarity, it says, "But if any widow has children or grandchildren," let them first, and we're talking about a widow, and especially in relation to the whole passage of an older age. "But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family, and to make some return to their parents. For this is acceptable in the sight of God." And then back to the King James, verse 16, it says, "If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed." In other words, the church should be responsible, as that first line of defense, should be responsible for only those who do not have a family to care for them. And thus, children are clearly, from this passage, responsible for their older parents. And note also verse 8 that says, "But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." End of quote. Now, I've used that on several occasions in past messages for different reasons, and used it in a more generic sense, which indeed I think it can be. It's a generic statement. But don't miss that it's specifically used here by Paul in relation to old age parental care. You are worse, Paul is saying, you are worse than an infidel if you refuse to care for your parents in their old age. Aristotle agreed with Paul. Quote, "It would be felt that our parents," this is Aristotle, "it would be felt that our parents have the first claim on us for maintenance, since we owe it to them as a debt, and to support the authors of our being stands before self-preservation in moral nobility." End of quote. That comes from Nicomachean Ethics 9:28. You know, the scriptures provide us with some great examples of old age parental care. First, and more generally, let's begin with Jacob. Even when his father was quite old, and Jacob himself was a grown man, he obeyed his parents regarding even the choice of who he was to marry. In Genesis 28:7, it says, "And Jacob obeyed his father and his mother and was gone to Paddan Aram." End of quote. Now, that's all it says there, but it's within the context of the fact that he'd gone to Paddan Aram to get himself a wife from his own people. Because Esau, and it's used in contrast to Esau, who wanting to scorn his parents, was taking wives from the Canaanites and the Ishmaelites, primarily the Canaanites, who were forbidden for Israel to marry. And so even at his old age, as an older man, as a mature male, obviously past the age of 20, he still obeyed his parents, in contrast to Esau, in regards to even who they wanted him to marry. But more specifically, let's consider Joseph, more specifically in regards to parental care, not just obedience. Let's consider Joseph. Turn with me to Genesis 45. Genesis chapter 45, and we'll begin with verse 9. Verse 9, verse 9, it says, "Haste ye, and go up to my father, and say unto him, Thus saith thy son Joseph." Joseph is here after he's revealed himself to his brothers in Egypt, is now telling them to go back to their father. "Thus saith thy son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me, tarry not. And thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen, and thou shalt be near unto me, thou and thy children and thy children's children, and thy flocks and thy herds, and all that thou hast. And there will," verse 11, "and there will I nourish thee, for yet there are 5 years of famine, lest thou and thy whole household and all that thou hast come to poverty." You know, it was the concern of a son for his elderly father. Father was already nearly blind and a very, very elderly man, and it wasn't really long for this life. Genesis 47:12, without turning there, says, "And Joseph nursed his father and his brethren and all his father's household with bread according to their families." It was the care of a son taking his father. He could have said, "Well, you know, dad can take care of himself. You know, he'll manage and let the other sons do it." No, he was the son of means. And we're going to see that there's another greater reason why Joseph primarily, providentially, was used in this fashion. But he was the one of certainly the most means to be able to take care of his father and the rest of his family. Yahshua, of course, fulfilled the fifth commandment and its statutes just as he did also all the rest of the law. Luke 2 and verse 51, for example, says, "And he went down with them," as he, Yahshua, went down with his parents, "and came to Nazareth," and then it says, "and was subject unto them." He was subject unto his parents. We're talking about the Son of God, the great I Am. Now, you may have been just a child, but nonetheless, he was all of that, was he not? And it still uses him as an example of being in subjection to his parents. By the way, Yahshua also demonstrates, or this passage also demonstrates here, that it is not insubordination to disobey a lower authority when obeying a higher authority requires that obedience. Now, let me say that one more time. It is not subordination, according to this passage, as we will see, to, and I should say, quote-unquote, disobey a lower authority when obeying a higher authority requires that you do so. Just prior to the verse that I just read to you is the account where Yahshua, at the age of 12, certainly not even a grown man yet, still under the authority of his parents, the God-ordained authority of his parents, it's the account of where Yahshua, at the age of 12, remained behind the returning caravan. The caravan who had been to Jerusalem was returning back to Nazareth. Where he remained behind in Jerusalem to discuss the law with the elders in the temple. You remember the account? And in verse 49, we're told, now I just read to you verse 51, where it says he wasn't subject, as he joined back up with the caravan with his parents, it says he was subject to his parents. I think that was probably ordained by God to be written, Because people, because he didn't want to leave his son out there looking like he was just a disobedient son, which in fact he was not. But it could have, that conclusion could have been drawn had verse 51 been had not been inspired by God to have been written. Because in verse 48 and 49 we're told, it says, "And when they," that is his parents, "saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us?" You know, they saw it as disobedience. I mean, and you can imagine how they probably were at least 3 or 4 days down, because they thought they were with, they thought that he was with relatives when in fact he wasn't. And so they had 2 or 3 days on the road maybe, and 2 or 3 days back. And I mean, here's a good part of a week, if not a full week, where this 12-year-old boy is missing. And so they're quite distraught and probably pretty upset with the young man, maybe as parents, forgetting, hey, this little guy is going to be the Messiah, the Savior of the world. And so they say, "Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing." And he said, and then he said unto them, "How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business?" End of that quote. Thus, verse 49 and 51 together demonstrate the hierarchy of authority and to whom we are required to submit. First and foremost, to Yahweh above all others, above all other authority. And then to those whom Yahweh has placed over us, and only to those when they are in harmony with Yahweh's authority. Now, regarding parental old age care, let's turn, in regards to Christ, let's now turn to John chapter 19. John chapter 19 and verse 26 through 27. And by the placement of this in the book of John, you might already know where we're going. John 19, verses 26 and 27. And it says, "And when Yeshua therefore saw his mother from where? On the cross, hanging on the cross. And when Yeshua therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son." The disciple whom he loved, who is that? John. "Woman, behold thy son." Verse 27. "Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour that disciple took her unto his own home." Even in his dying hour, Yeshua provided for his mother's needs by making sure that in his physical absence that she would be taken care of. Now, with that, if the children's, with that, and those are just examples that show that even, of course, Yeshua fulfilled that perfectly, but even if it's the children's responsibility to care for elderly parents, then a question that's going to come up in the minds of some people I know and needs to be answered is, then who's primarily responsible for such parental care in a larger family where there's many children there? Is it just kind of spread out equally, or who's, is there one that's particularly responsible? Well, according to the Apostle Paul, in 1 Timothy 5:16, it says, "If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them," it goes on to say. In other words, to ensure that such a widow or other needy family member is properly taken care of, the Apostle Paul declares that if you're a Christian, just simply consider it your duty to make sure that it gets taken care of. Because Christians of all people should be the first to be there to fulfill, obviously, the commandments of God, this fifth commandment statute. However, according to God's law, there is an order of responsibility, or a priority of responsibility, or you could say even a hierarchy of responsibility. It is specially or primarily the responsibility of, anybody know? The eldest son. It is primarily the responsibility of the eldest son. It's known as the law of primogeniture. Turn with me now to Deuteronomy chapter 21. Deuteronomy 21, verses 15 through 17. Verse 15, "If a man have two wives, one beloved and another hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, And if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be, when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion, by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength, the right of the firstborn is his. In other words, according to this passage, it was made clear that a father was not to have favoritism. Now you say, what do you mean he's not to have favoritism? You know, he gets the firstborn gets double portion. Well, that's God that's mandating that. Okay, let's not mix it up with the Father. The Father, if he does so, is just following the orders of the Heavenly Father. But in this passage, it's clear that personal favoritism is not to enter in when it comes to the right, the birthright of the firstborn son. The right of the firstborn son is a double portion or a double inheritance over that of the rest of the heirs, no matter how many there are. He is to get a double portion. Well, that sure seems unfair, you know. Well, is God unfair? Certainly not. So why do you think that primogeniture was established as a part of God's law? Well, because with that right also comes a greater responsibility. Not without exceptions, the firstborn was, and should be today, by the way, the patriarch in waiting, the heir apparent of the whole household. And although certainly abused, it's something like the godfather principle in the mafia. That's probably not the best illustration to use, but it's the best one I could come up with. Because they seem to have, even though it's abused, seem to have carried on that kind of principle. I don't know if it's always to the firstborn, but it would appear that that would be the case. But that's really what we're talking about, the godfather principle, or much better, the patriarch principle. That, again, as we've become so diversified as families and so separated that our families are no more clans that are together, as I believe God would have us to be. Part of the consequence, not the result, but the consequence of the Industrial Revolution is the separating of the family. And isn't that what so often the enemies of God, the enemies of Christianity, our enemies, so often want to do? They want to destroy the family unit. You look at those on the left, they're always against the family, against that unit. You know, look at Hollywood that represents the left, the liberals. It is, I mean, you can't hardly find a show if you watch TV at all, and I don't watch all that much, but what I've seen, and I'm sure it's the case throughout, that you can't hardly find a show. I won't even watch the sitcoms, but as you happen to go by through the channel changer, you see that there's not, I don't know of one that has a normal family unit with a mother and a father that hasn't been divorced and all of this other stuff. Actually, a mother and a father with children living at home. You know, it's all messed up. They're trying to destroy the family unit. God, I think, intended for this to continue on, this clan aspect. Why? For the care of the family, if for no other reason. Anyway, that patriarchal, get the patriarchal picture in your mind. And the firstborn son was to be the patriarch in waiting, if you will, the heir apparent. That's something, by the way, that if it is to be reinstated, which I hope that this message will at least help to begin to see that it is once again, that's something, by the way, that young ladies should give some considerable thought to before marrying a firstborn son. Because she needs to understand that there's going to be responsibilities as the wife of that firstborn son that she may have to take on, and she'd better be prepared for. I'm going to talk to any prospective wife of my firstborn son and let her know very clearly what's going to probably be required. You know, I don't want her to all of a sudden get the shock of her life, you know, down the road a little bit. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the eldest son is the one who always will always house their parents. But he is primarily responsible for making sure that the care is provided for and even paid for. That's the reason for the double portion. Now, regrettably, the double portion isn't going to the firstborn sons anymore, so many times they don't have any more means to take care of the parents than the rest of the children do. But you can now see the wisdom that God said, here is the firstborn son has a greater responsibility, thus he has a greater right and greater privilege. Now, if we're interested in returning to Yah's laws for today, as we should be, I mean, why not? There is not a major problem that we face in America or in this world that God's laws wouldn't immediately take care of, as I pointed out in many messages in the past. It's not for our justification, but it's sure for our well-being. God didn't institute anything in his life that wasn't the best for his people. Why wouldn't we want to return to it? And certainly, God expects us to, in loving him with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and in loving our neighbor as ourselves. How do we do that? Through the law. The law dictates how that's to be done. So God expects that from us as our Christian responsibilities as well. And if we are interested in restoring Yah's laws for society today to clean up the society that we live in, then the law of primogeniture needs to also be reinstated. But some might be concerned that, you know, their children, at least the second-born and subsequent children, may have a problem with that, you know, double portion to the firstborn son. Well, not if you've taught them properly from the beginning, early in their lives. Not if you've taught them that we are to obey God's laws and that God always, always knows best. Now, not that there may not be some exceptions to the child who, for some reason, grows up greedy, but I think it would be a minority of the cases where they've been taught early and taught to love God and to love his law that that's going to be the case. I've already spoken to my children at least twice about this. The first time, you should have seen my eldest son's face when I told him that he was to get a double portion of the inheritance. Man, his face lit up. And his eyes got big. And by the way, the other children, the next two in line who could understand what we were talking about, their faces did about just the opposite. Until I also explained to him the responsibility that comes with it. And what it'll mean, possibly mean, when Linda and I get older. Then he and the others could see that it probably all equaled out. Pretty well, pretty good. So my children have been prepared early that that's the way it's going to be. My eldest son is going to get a double portion of the inheritance. And I don't think any of them have a problem with it. In fact, I think probably the three younger children, the two oldest of the three that understand, are probably relieved that they're not the firstborn son. When it's the picture, and I mean, I depicted the picture pretty graphically of what it just may mean. You know, kind of the opposite, you know, as one goes from a baby to the other extreme of life, you know, you kind of sometimes end up in the state of babyhood. You know, parents, as they get old and more feeble and so forth. And I said, it may be that you're going to have to do with us what we did with you. So he's not looking very happy about that. But let me tell you, and let me tell him, it is a great privilege, albeit one that we comes, that one with a great responsibility as well. However, the right of primogeniture can be lost or forfeited as a consequence of moral failure. Both Reuben and Esau are examples of that. When Jacob blessed his 12 sons prior to his death, to Reuben he declared this, quote, Reuben being the firstborn, he says, Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water, thou shalt not excel, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defilest thouest it, he went up to my couch, end of quote. Reuben had defiled one of Jacob's wives. That's Genesis 49:3-4. A father could not take away, or was not to take away, the right of the firstborn simply based on favoritism. But he had the right to remove it based on morality or moral failure. We're also told that that birthright privilege of Reuben's was then given to Joseph. In 1 Chronicles 5:1 it says, "Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, and the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright." End of that quote. And now, isn't it interesting, perhaps, or without question, providential, that it was Joseph who had now been given the double portion, the birthright, who provided for his family, for his father in his old age, and the rest of the family in their hour of need. Now, what if there are no sons in a family? What then? Well, Yah's law takes care of that as well. Turn to Numbers chapter 27, and I'm going to have to read these as I get to them, so if you're not there, just listen. Chapter 27, Numbers 27, and beginning with verse 1, it says, "Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Maker, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph," and these are the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noah, Hogla, poor Hogla, and Milcah and Tirzah. "And they stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the princes and all the congregation by the door of the tabernacle, the congregation, saying, 'Our father died in the wilderness, and he was not in the company of them that gathered themselves together against Yahweh in the company of Korah, but died in his own sin and had no sons. Why should the name of our father be done away from among his family because he hath no sons? Give unto us therefore a possession among the brethren of our father.' And Moses brought their cause before Yahweh, and Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, 'The daughters of Zelophehad speak right. Thou shalt surely give them a possession of an inheritance among their father's brethren, and thou shalt cause the inheritance of their father to pass unto them. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, If a man die and have no son, then ye shall cause his inheritance to pass unto his daughter.'" Obviously, the firstborn, right of the firstborn son, if there were no sons, were to pass on to the firstborn daughter and her family. But what if a set of parents are completely without children? Well, let's pick it up where we left off. Verse 9, "And if he have no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance unto his brethren." Brethren there meaning, that's a term that's used generically in many cases, as just meaning other fellow Israelites, but in this case it means this man's brothers and sisters, the inheritance and the right and the patriotic aspect of caring for his particular family and their line would then pass on to a brother or sister of the one who is then passing on. Continuing, verses 10 and 11, "And if he have no brethren," no brothers or sisters, "then you shall give his inheritance unto his father's brethren. And if his father have no brethren, then you shall give his inheritance unto his kinsmen, that is, next to him of his family, and he shall possess it, and it shall be unto the children of Israel a statute of judgment, as Yahweh commanded Moses." It was to be kept in the family. Because, of course, it was the family who was, in most cases, most likely to take the best care or be most interested in caring for any family member that was in need or destitute. Now, it's interesting that Yeshua, as the eldest son, passed on, in light of what we just read, passed on the responsibility and care of his mother to the apostle John rather than to his own brother James, the next in line. Well, possibly a reason for that is at the time of Yeshua's crucifixion, this changed later, but at the time of Yeshua's crucifixion, James and his other brothers were not believers in him. Were not Christians, in other words, or didn't become Christians until at a later time. And or, we don't know this, but possibly did not have the financial means to take care of Mary. That could have been a part of it too. So, as such, Yeshua obviously knew that Mary would be better cared for under the care of Joseph than he would in at the hand of his own brothers. But you say, no, wait a minute. We just read in in that last passage that it was to be retained in the family. Well, guess what? John was family. John was a cousin of Yahshua. And Yahshua, with his infinite knowledge, knew that in this particular case, it would be Mary would do better in the hands in his care than he would in one of his own brothers. You know, regrettably, for the most part, the fact and or the principle of primogeniture has been discarded by today's family along with the majority of the rest of God's laws. And thus, if you think about it, it really shouldn't surprise us that today's government has stepped in to fill the void. After all, think about this. The primary responsibility of parental and family care was to be that of the firstborn son, the one who sometimes would be called probably big brother. And isn't that also a term that our society uses for our government? You see, any time that we reject God's plans for our lives, there is always a counterfeit surrogate to fill the vacancy. And it usually turns everything upside down. You know, how good is Big Brother, to quote-unquote Big Brother, doing today? Why don't we go back to God's way? You know, do they really care about how you fend? You know, anybody who knows it knows it's just a system that further rapes and takes advantage of the weak and the elderly. Why not let the real Big Brother do it instead of the counterfeit? Speaking of counterfeit replacements, just quickly, many churches and ministries are also contributing, in a roundabout way at least, to parental desertion and also involved in dispossessing children of their biblical inheritance. Now, how is that done? Well, it's become a fairly common practice among certain ministries to appeal to their older supporters to assign the ministry as the heir to part or all of their estate. And I won't name some, but I can name some very well-known ministries who are doing this. After all, you know, it's a final and parting way to give to God while you're passing from this life to the other. And what a better way to enter into the presence of God. You know, it sounds noble, doesn't it? Well, on the surface, so did the Corbin argument of the Pharisees. You know, we can't give to you because this has already been set aside and dedicated to God. When in fact, it's nothing more than another quote-unquote ingenious way to rob, if not the parents themselves, then certainly those who are the rightful heirs of the inheritance. An inheritance does not belong to a church or a ministry. And I'll just let it be known for those across this nation and wherever else these tapes go, don't give your inheritance to this ministry. If I find out it's an inheritance, I'm going to send it back to you. It belongs to the family, as we read in Deuteronomy. It belongs to one's family. Proverbs 13 and verse 22, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. To his children's children. I've mentioned before the ungodly bumper sticker that is often seen on the back today of many Winnebagos that reads, "We're spending our children's inheritance." The ungodly bumper sticker. Just the opposite of what we just read in Proverbs 13:22. Well, that's essentially what such ministries are doing. They're just spending someone else's children's inheritance. And in some cases, even robbing the parents of in-home care, since in many cases the children, the rightful heirs, without the inheritance, are financially incapable of caring for their own parents and must then relegate their parents to a nursing home. And speaking of nursing home, it's become another tradition of men in our present society, to pawn off parental care onto someone else. Sometimes the government, sometimes nursing homes. And rather than taking the time to devote to that subject, the time that it really should be, in greater detail, I'm intending, Lord willing, with this particular message, to also send out a message on tape entitled Honor Them Always by David Thomas, who's up in Minnesota. And he does a fine and thorough job of exposing the problems with nursing homes in a very unique fashion. And so I'm going to send that with us, and we'll let that suffice to take care of that. We have become a society of not only irresponsible people, but in more ways than one, we have also become a throwaway society. Isn't that often talked about, this society? It's become a throwaway society. But in a much more grievous, much more serious manner than what it's normally declared to be. Even, we've become a throwaway society, even when it comes to our own parents, to whom we owe our very life. In many cases, in shirking one's responsibility, nursing homes are this society's human garbage bins for unwanted parents. However, I think I would be remiss if I were not to point out that nursing homes may very well be a part of God's judgment upon the generation who legalized infanticide, that is, the murder and the throwing in the garbage bins of our children, of our babies. You know, it comes full circle, doesn't it? And either because they murdered their heirs, who should be caring for them in their old age, or because they simply passed on the same mental outlook to their living heirs, and they are now being thrown away as well. The consequences of breaking the commandments and statutes of Yahweh our God, when you start getting into it, just keep compounding. It just adds one thing on top of another. Society becomes more and more destitute. Why? Because we have thrown away God's laws. Jeremiah 6:19, Hear, O earth, behold, I will bring evil upon this people, even the fruit of their thoughts, because they have not hearkened unto my words nor to my law, but rejected it. When will we ever learn? Well, stay tuned for the sixth and final part of the Fifth Commandment series as we continue in this series and continue in our elaboration or exposition of God's law. Let's stand and look.